TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Ilan Pappé, the U.S. has no limits when it comes to Israel. The historian Ilan Pappé comments on the missile launch to Tel Aviv, the ICC ruling, and his own interrogation by the FBI. Ilan Pappé is an Israeli historian and political scientist. He's now a professor at the University of Exeter in the UK. His best-known book is The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, based on declassified British and Israeli government documents. The book explains that the expulsions of Palestinians were executed based on a plan drawn up in 1947 by Israel's future leaders. Ilan Pappé left Israel in 2008 after being condemned in the Knesset. A minister of education had called for him to be sacked. Frank Barat, the French activist, author, and film producer, and longtime friend of Ilan Pappé, spoke with him on his podcast on May 26, 2024. This was within days of the missile launch into Israel, the International Criminal Court request for arrest warrants, and Pappé's detention by the FBI when he arrived in Detroit for a speaking tour. Here's their conversation.
Hello, Ilan.
Hi, Frank. Good to see you.
We've been speaking every few months for about 10 years, but even more like in the last like 7 months. And I prepared this interview because I do prepare my interviews. And I wanted to start by asking you about what happened about 10 days ago in the US, in Detroit, when you were interrogated by federal agents. But in fact, something happened a few hours ago that I maybe want to start with. And what happened a few hours ago is that Hamas and its military wing launched a pretty massive rocket attack on Israel. What's your opinion on this? Because if we listen to Israel, they've been carpet bombing Gaza for 7 months to eradicate Hamas. If you listen to Israel, Hamas and you know the Al-Qassam Brigade's military capacity has been really, really sort of damaged. But then Hamas shows that it looks like nothing of the sort happened. So what does it mean for the whole last 7 months, in a way?
Yeah, it has two sides to it, because the missiles were launched from Rafah. So on the one hand, Israel can concoct a narrative that says, you see, that's why we have to go into Rafah, the only place that we have not occupied. And that's what they are already saying. But you're right, there's something more profound here, and that is the military failure of Israel to defeat the Hamas in terms of its military capacity, its presence in Gaza. It's obvious that they have not fully understood until now how the Hamas is organized, structured, and so on. And their promises to the Israeli society that this is a feasible objective of the war. Not only that, that this kind of takeover of Gaza would be the main way of releasing the hostages. All this is crumbling down, definitely. So I think if until now a lot of Israelis lost their confidence in the Israeli army because of what happened the 7th of October, I think there's another reason why they would be a bit less confident in the army. And a lack of confidence in the army has, of course, more profound implications for the sense of invincibility, the lack of horizon in the future, the vision for the future. We already knew that you cannot uproot the Hamas as a political force, an ideological force, whatever the Israeli will do. But it seems that they're also not able to really uproot it militarily. So on the one hand, they will use it to ignore the ICJ ruling on Rafah. On the other hand, deep in the Israeli public, this would, as I say, erode the confidence, not only in the political leadership, but also in the military leadership.
Thanks, Ilan. You talked about the Israeli public. there is still this myth in Europe, or in like so-called liberal Europe, that the left exists in Israel and that there's a peace movement in Israel. We've seen lots of demonstrations in Israel in the past few months. Most of them call for the release of the hostages. A few of them call for the end of the war, but hardly, I mean, a very, very, very small group calls for, you know, the war being a genocide and for the end of the occupation, etc. Do you think there's a way that what's happened in the last 7 months, including what's happened today with Hamas launching rockets, including many hostages still in Gaza dying under, you know, Israeli bombing, do you think there's a way that Israeli society or a part of Israeli society could finally see that this goes beyond the army or beyond Netanyahu being a bad guy? Or have you also lost hope in Israeli society?
Well, it's a bit more complicated. I do think that the number of Israeli Jews who are willing to see the end of the war is much larger than it was 2 months ago. I still think the majority would feel that if, let's say, Netanyahu declares the end of the war, that it's a failure. And those who are his electoral base, those who are on the right, really the electorate that brought this coalition to power in November 2022, would still support very much an intensified military action in Gaza. The other camp, the more liberal Israeli camp, we cannot call it the left, of course, anymore, and it's more kind of center-right camp in Israeli political terms, I think becomes tired of the war, cannot see its purpose anymore. It's still a minority, but it's a much larger minority than was before. It's interesting that the narrative that the families and those who support them and those who oppose Netanyahu have, the narrative is, let's have a swap of prisoners. Let's stop the war. I haven't heard from anyone, let's stop the war because there's a genocide. Nobody says it in Israel. I mean, there are a few individuals who do, of course, and the Arabs of Israel say it. But you know, the vast majority in the so-called liberal camp, they say, let's stop the war so that we can bring the hostages back home, and then we can continue the war. I think that is what probably in Europe is so difficult to understand, that their reasoning for asking for a ceasefire is to bring back the hostages, which is fine, which is definitely a noble and justified request. But there is not even a modicum of compassion to the people of Gaza, which is really incredible if you think about it. And they would like Netanyahu to go, that is true. But again, I think both of us know that even if Netanyahu goes, Benny Gantz, Lapid, whoever will win, or might probably win the next election, I think Netanyahu might lose it, will continue the military actions in the Gaza Strip, would continue the harsh policy in the West Bank. But on the ground, I'm afraid that they have no plan B, they have no strategy, and therefore position in Israel is to Netanyahu, to the idea that you cannot stop the war for hostage swap, but there is no opposition to punishing, if you want, in adverted commas, all the people of Gaza and using similar methods in the West Bank and suppressing any freedom of speech for the Palestinians inside Israel.
When we spoke about 6 months ago now, so sort of at the early stages of the genocide, you told me that what was happening in Gaza was an incremental genocide. You know, you said at the time, Israel's not going to go with the atomic bomb and erase Gaza. They could, but they're not, because, you know, the international community would have to say, no, this is not right. They will go incrementally. You've been proven 100% right. But at the time, and seeing what's happened in the last 6 months, did you think Israel could go that far? Because we've seen some of the most horrific scenes and actions and bombardments and killings and torture I have ever seen in my life. I'm 47 years old, you know. Did you expect that Israel and actually the international community, and I'm talking about states, would let this happen at this scale?
I was surprised by the level of brutality. I mean, I expected a very brutal reaction after the 7th of October, but not at that level. I didn't really expect it to be a genocide of that kind. And similarly, I didn't expect that a genocide that is daily broadcasted to us on our small screen, our bigger screen, which we cannot say that we don't know. Nobody can say that they don't know. It's so visible in our screens, as I said. I didn't think that Britain and the United States in particular could adopt such a callous position and continue to immunize Israel. I mean, I understood the early reactions, you know, 2-3 weeks after the 7th of October, the kind of sympathy that European and American, European governments, United States showed to Israel because of what happened on the 7th of October. And I understood the discourse that they used of the right of self-defense. But that was before we understood what was going on in Gaza. The fact that this is still the discourse is incredible. And but if the international tribunals, legal tribunals, will be able eventually to have a powerful position towards Israel, it will not stop with Israel. It will, I think, be also about those countries that were complicit either by military aid or by their silence and support for these actions on the ground.
I'm going to talk about this now. So in the last few weeks, really, in the last few days, we've had the two highest judicial bodies in the world, the International Criminal Court, asking for an arrest warrant against Gallant and Netanyahu, which is historical because usually they don't go after so-called, you know, democracies or Western states. It's actually the first time they'll go. I mean, there's Putin, but I guess he's not considered part of the Western world. So this is historical, despite the massive pressures that Karim Khan has been under and has been facing, and the threats as well. You have the ICJ, the highest UN court, so the International Court of Justice, asking Israel now to stop its bombing of Gaza. You have Norway, Spain, and Ireland recognizing Palestine, I think, on the 29th, so it's in about 3 days, which I think will bring the number of countries that recognize Palestine to about 146. So a huge majority, and some others are coming. I think Slovenia is coming up as well. You have student occupations all over the world in the biggest universities in the world. You have more and more celebrities and people finally speaking out on Palestine in support of Palestine. So, you know, I've been immersed in the Palestine question for nearly 20 years now. I have never felt myself that Israel has been that, in a way, isolated. What's your view on that?
Yes, I think you're right. This unprecedented level of isolation, there's no doubt. Let's start with the ICJ and ICC. We have to remember, unlike domestic legal systems, international legal systems are more susceptible to political influence. And there are two kinds of political influence you get when you are dealing in an international tribunal with Palestine. You have pressure from the political elites that would like you to continue provide Israel an exceptional position and treat it as a Western country, and therefore the ICJ and ICC should not deal with Israel. It is, as you say, it's only for Russia and the global South. But you also have the pressure, and they are fully aware of it, of the global South and the civil societies in the global North that demand that the governments would take a tough action against Israel. And there is the gap, of course, between the politics from above and the politics from below in the global North towards Israel. I think what the judges there felt that they can narrow the gap and not only reflect the political elite's wishes on Israel, but also reflect authentically what the vast sections of the civil society around the world feels about Israel. And I think that's what they were doing. I think for many years they waited for the political elites to do this. They didn't want to be those who initiated actions against Israel. And that's why even a prosecutor that Israel and America demanded would be appointed felt that he has to respond not just to the legal question, which of course he did, but also to the fact that they represent the global world. They don't represent Western governments only. And so I think that's very important, despite many people would say there's some deficiencies in, they didn't mention genocide in the ICC and so on. Let's put all that aside. Basically, it's incredible compared to anything that happened before. And of course, it's not surprising that a country from the global south is the one that initiated the procedure. There's no way that even a relatively pro-Palestinian state would initiate such a process. So that's very, very important. Still, we have to see how it unfolds. What are the practical implications? They don't have much power of sanctions and so on. But nonetheless, I think historically, in the wider context, we will see it as a very important landmark in the movement, I think, towards sanctions towards Israel, because we have already boycott and divestment. And the students, of course, movement has helped to turn divestment into something far more widespread, practical, and convince some of the university management to take action on divestment. And that's also something that didn't happen before. Not only that, I think they led academics around the world for the first time who already were not very forthcoming towards their Israeli colleagues, for the first time to tell the Israeli colleagues why they're not cooperating with this. And I think that has a lot to do with the students' movement. As for the recognition, I don't underestimate the importance of the recognition of Palestine. I think in this context, I mean, you know, if it happened 2 years ago, we would have said, yes, so what? They're recognizing the PA, they're recognizing Area A in the PA. You know, the historical context is always very important. The context of where we are now suddenly makes this recognition something that we think is very significant, not because of the PA, not because the PA is suddenly recognized as a real government or having a sovereign state, because the explanation that Spain, Norway, and Ireland gave is important, that the Israeli actions in Gaza pushed them and others to have this kind of idea. As you know, I don't support the two-state solution, so I'm not impressed by the fact that they connected to the two-state solution. But I think for many people in the world Palestine in the recognition is not necessarily the geographical space that the PA controls, or even a possible mini state if Israel would ever allow it in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I think for many people, it means after 76 years of denial, finally the government say that Palestine exists, the Palestinian exists, they are the victims, they are not the criminals, and they deserve justice. And they deserve to be heard, and we should hear what they want and not all the time hear what the Israelis want. So I think there is this is also very important, not just about isolating Israel. It's for the first time that two questions are being asked that haven't been asked before. Not is what is the future of the Palestinians, but rather what is the future of Israel. This is a question nobody asked. First time we're asking the question, what is the future of Israel? And secondly, for the first time, the Palestinians are asked about the vision for the future, and they're not asked to respond to an Israeli peace plan. So this is all very, very cardinal, very unprecedented, and time will tell how it affects realities on the ground, but I think it has huge potential to do so.
Thanks, Ilan. Finally, I want to go back to the question I wanted to ask you first. So we see all these solidarity, all its solidarity, you know, all over the world that, you know, takes many forms. But what we've also seen, and this is why for me, this is a moment of incredible clarity. You know, you know, it's important to count each other at some point, you know, who is with us, who is against us. And the repression and the censorship that has happened on social media, in university, at a diplomatic level, is also mind-blowing. I mean, when you see riot police going to attack students in universities in Switzerland, in France, in Belgium, in the US, when you see, you know, very violent pro-Israel mobs beating up peaceful pro-Palestinians with the police watching. The moment is incredibly clear, but in a way, repression and censorship takes many forms. And you have yourself, so you went to the US about 10 days ago. Mm-hmm. You flew to Detroit, and I guess at your surprise, or maybe not, you were detained and interrogated for 2 hours by federal agents. Could you, I mean, I know you spoke about this quite a lot on Democracy Now! and things, but could you explain what happened again in a few minutes?
Yeah.
And why do you think this happened?
Yeah. Well, yes, I arrived in the U.S. and immediately taken to a small room on the side with two agents, which I should say were cordial, were not abusive, but they refused to tell me why they stopped me. And they had kind of two rounds of questions, one about my opinions on certain issues, such as the Hamas, the situation in Gaza, whether I think it's a genocide, and also about the slogan, Palestine should be free from the river to the sea, which I handled, I think, well, because I'm a teacher and I really used it. You know, I sort of looked at them as students who don't know anything. That was not so bad. I mean, it was not nice, but and it was cheeky. And I think, and more I hear from my lawyers in America, was also illegal in many ways. So we're still pursuing it, and we'll see what we'll do. They're not allowed, apparently. I was too tired to know that they're not allowed to ask these questions. In fact, what the thing is that I could have said, and I want a lawyer, but then I would have stayed for 9 hours in the airport, you know. So there's no easy way out of it. But what was really troubling was the second part of the discussion, so to speak, interrogation. One is that they asked for names of Arabs and Muslims in America that I know, asked me about several organizations, and that was very worrying for me. And then they took over my phone and copied everything in it, which, again, I wasn't sure whether they have the right to do it or not. But again, I understood that if I refused, you know, I'm delaying. And I waited quite a while for them to return the phone. And then they said that I have to wait until they make several phone calls. I don't know who they called. And eventually they let me go. I think that whoever is behind it, I'm not sure these two agents took a decision by themselves, of course, came from high above, is that there are two things which are important. And that's why I publicized it, because I think it will help many of my Arab American friends who feel that they are alone in these kinds of situation. And I hope that if we publicize these cases, the federal agencies will be a bit more careful with what they're doing. They have this narrative that professors of history or senior non-academics, which is really false, are behind the student movements. They come and they are the ones who instigate these kinds of actions, which of course is ridiculous. The students did not need us to do what they did. The second one is to deter you from coming back, you know, that you will think twice, because whoever thought that your coming to America is not good. Again, I don't have all the information, I must say. I don't know exactly if the Israelis pressured them or the pro-Israeli lobby, you know. I just finished a book, Lobbying for Zionism on Two Sides of the Atlantic, and I realized that AIPAC sometimes acts as a state by its own. I mean, AIPAC can take an action like this without even consulting Israel. You know, they're very powerful, and they think themselves very powerful, so they don't consult on anything with Israel. So they could be behind it. The idea is to deter you. You'll think twice if every time you come to the States. This is less important. I think what is important to see it in the context, as you said rightly, it's part of the suppression. This is what happened to the rector of Glasgow University, Rassan Abusita, who was denied the entry to Germany and France. This is happening to a lot of other people who speak openly and courageously on Palestine. And especially they're targeting the people who are known to show that they can reach everyone. I mean, It's easy, of course, to target students, so on. And I think that's where they will fail, because people like us, I'm not saying we're immune. We're not immune from anything, and anything can happen to us. I'm fully aware of it. But I think that they are lost with ideas of what to do. Instead of, as I told these agents, I said to them, you know, just watch what's happening in Gaza and you stop asking these questions. Maybe you don't know what's going on there. I said, forget Hamas, forget what do you care if I'm for one state or two states? Who cares? Why do you care you are in Detroit? But don't ask why people are doing what they're doing, for God's sake, you know? And I think they were a bit embarrassed by my response to this. As I say, it's not their decision, you know, they had to do this. But I think, yeah, it is worrying because I kept saying to them, you don't stop professor of history for 2 hours for coming to give 3 lectures on history. I said, you lost your mind doing this. That is why I exposed it, as you write. I think you're right. It's a general suppression. The ordeal was not terrible, but it shows that they have no limits when it comes to Israel. And this is important given what's going on the ground. So as much as the solidarity movement has swelled and increased, the counter movement is now taking off its gloves and will do all it can to kill the messengers, because they cannot change the message. So if killing the messengers is stopping me for 2 hours in Detroit, it's not too bad, but I'm afraid they can do, not necessarily to me, but they can do, and they've already done, worse things to people in order to stop them. But it will not work, as you know, Frank. It will not work. None of us will stop saying what we are saying. None of us will stop writing what we are writing. We feel we are on the right side of history, and we'll do all we can to help the Palestinian in the struggle for liberation and freedom.
Thanks, Ilan. No better way to end. And yes, we will not stop until it ends. And I think, you know, being and knowing that you're on the right side of history is a very powerful, impulse, you know. And so, yeah, thank you, Ilan.
Thank you, Frank. It was always great talking to you.
Thanks.
And hope to see you soon. Okay.
Same. Bye-bye, Ilan.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That was a conversation with the Israeli historian Ilan Pappé. He's now a professor at the University of Exeter in the UK. Frank Barat, the French activist, author, and film producer, spoke with him on May 26, 2024. You can find the full 29-minute talk on YouTube under the title Ilan Pappé, the U.S. has no limits when it comes to Israel. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.